So, welcome to week 4 of our look at Ashirim. Last time round, we started talking about Midrash on Shir Ashirim, specifically the collection that is Shir Ashirim Rabbah. And what we saw, aside from sort of a general discussion about bodies of Midrash, and why they're collected and what they're trying to accomplish, that I'm going to leave from last week. But we talked about how Shir HaShirim Rabbah reads Shir HaShirim and what it understands to be the goal and meaning of Shir HaShirim. And we saw that it places a strong emphasis on how we, the Jewish people, are beloved to Hashem. We saw the debate between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir as to whether Shir HaShirim can ever be interpreted as saying something negative or harsh about the Jewish people, and the answer was no. Everything in Shir HaShirim has to be positive about us, even though we know that there are midrashim which don't make it into Shir HaShirim Rabbah, which see criticism of the Jews in Shir HaShirim, in particular an association with the Egel, with the golden calf. But Shir HaShirim Rabbah would like to act as though that doesn't exist, as though that's not here. So we saw a midrash last time that Janine flagged and said, hey, wait a minute, there's something odd going on in this midrash, and I wanted to revisit it because I thought that it was worth actually seeing what this midrash was doing. It was a midrash on one of the opening lines in Shir HaShirim in which the female voice says of the male, Yishakeni minishikos pihu. He should kiss me from the kisses of his mouth. And the Medrash said, this was our hubris in demanding that we should hear from Hashem directly at Sinai. So Janine noted that in fact, we are told after the Aseres Hadibros, after the Ten Commandments, that the Jews said to Moshe, you speak to us, we don't want to hear from God. That seems to be the opposite of what the Medrash said. So the answer is that you need to see the rest of that midrash, which I hadn't brought last time because I was just bringing it, an excerpt to make my point. But now I'll explain what that midrash is doing. If you see source number 1 on your sheet, I gave you a reference to Shmot chapter 19. This is in the lead up to the presentation of the Torah at Sinai when Moshe is acting as a courier, bringing messages from God to the Jews, and then the Jews' response back to God. So if you take a look in Shmot chapter 19, sentence 7, this is right after Hashem has told Moshe to tell the Jews that they should be a nation of priests, a holy nation, and it says, Vayavo Moshe, vayikra lezikne ha'am. Moshe came and he called the elders of the nation. Vayasem lefnehem es kol ha'drim ha'ela asher tzivahu Hashem. He put before the elders all of the things that Hashem had told him to convey. So Moshe reports to the Jews all the things that Hashem wants him to report. And the nation responds there in sentence 8. Vayanu chalam yachta. The whole nation responded together and they said, everything that God said we will do. And we're told Moshe brought the nation's words back to God. So far, so good. But then it continues and says, and Hashem said to Moshe, I'm going to come to you in a cloud so that the nation will hear when I speak with you. And they will believe you forever. They'll trust you. And Moshe conveyed the nation's words to Hashem. So I already have one problem. Moshe already gave God the Jews' response in sentence 8. What new response was there to give in sentence 9? We don't know of any new reaction. We haven't seen anything. That's problem number 1. Problem number 2 is that after that, in sentence 10, Hashem says to Moshe, go tell the nation that they should sanctify themselves. They have to repair, they have to wash their clothing and be prepared on the third day, because on the third day, Hashem is going to ascend before the eyes of the entire nation at Sinai. But I don't understand. Back in sentence 9, Hashem said, I'm going to come to you, Moshe, in the cloud, and the Jews are just going to overhear a conversation. There was nothing about Hashem being visible to the Jews. So what happened that in sentence 11, Hashem changes the plan? So what this midrash is doing is it's saying that in between, Moshe conveyed the Jews' response to Hashem, which was their statement of whatever Hashem is diber, whatever Hashem says, not what Hashem says to you, not what Hashem said before, what Hashem says to us, we will do. It was a request for a conversation, a monologue from God. They requested direct witnessing of Hashem's word, which Hashem had not even, said was going to happen. And then when they actually heard God, then they said, oh, well, that's a little too much. That we can't deal with. That's what this midrash is conveying. And the midrash actually has a later piece in which it says, the reason Hashem went along with it was because otherwise, golden calf, they would say, well, the reason we did it was because we didn't hear you directly, God. So this was a way to diffuse that and say, nope, you had your opportunity. So that's in terms of the midrash that we had learned at the end last week. That midrash, by the way, does not deal with the line in which the Jews said, speak to us, no, I'm sorry, don't speak to us, speak to Moshe. That they wanted Moshe to convey it. I think the reason the Medrash doesn't do that is because that would be an example of Genai. That would be an example of something that's negative about the Jews. So that's why the Medrash doesn't deal with it. Two other notes from last week. Number one, I mispronounced the name. I referenced the early bishop, Origen. I had said Oregon, so it's not. It's Origen. My mistake. And then that's what happens when you read things. And then the other is that there was one instance of Shemos, the name of Hashem, in a source on last week's sheet. It was the piece from Dr. Kadari, which is in number 6 on this week's sheet. So last week's, I had missed a name of Hashem in the Dr. Kadari quote. So if you printed out last week's sheet, know that that is, that that's there. Okay, so moving forward now into this week, what I want to do is complete our understanding of what the Midrashim are looking to do. What is Shir HaShirim Rabbah looking to do in its read of Shir HaShirim? That's number one. And with as much time as we have left after that, I want to start on Rashi's view. And as I wrote in the email when I sent out the source sheet, I have a brand new appreciation for what Rashi does on Shir HaShirim now that I looked at the Medrash first and I realized what Rashi is doing. It's amazing what he pulls off in this commentary on Shir HaShirim. So when we get to that, God willing, you will also be amazed. Let's start with the Midrashim though. I wanted to show you one more Midrash which demonstrates divine love for the Jews. And that's source number 2 on your sheet with a remarkable story. This is sometimes known as the Midrash of the Tens, like the number 10. Midrash of the Tens. Because it goes through a series of things that involve the number 10, which we're mostly going to ignore. But I just brought the first part of it. Source number 2, I'm just going to go with my English translation in the interests of time. On the line in Shir HaShirim, Nagila v'nismecha vach, let us exult and rejoice in you. 10 expressions of joy are employed in Israel's regard. This is God speaking about the Jews. 10 different terms. Gila, Sisa, Simcha, Rina, Pitzcha, Tzahala, Alatza, Alaza, it should be, Chedva, and Trua. Remember, this translation here is adapted from the Sefaria Medrash Rabbah. So I do not take responsibility for their errors, although I did correct some of them. But it's Alaza, not Elza. This isn't somebody from Frozen or something. This is different. Alaza. Okay. So it continues to say, another matter. Let us exult and rejoice in you. God saying to the Jews, let us exult and rejoice in you. We learned there, if a man marries a woman and stays with her for 10 years and she has not given birth, he may not remain idle. Meaning that if a couple's been married for 10 years, they haven't been able to have children, there is a fear classically that means that they will not, as a couple, be able to produce children, and he should go looking for an additional wife. That was historically recommended, whether it was practiced, when it was practiced, when it wasn't practiced, all interesting discussions, not for right now. Not where we're going. But the Medrash here says the following. Rabbi Edi said, there was an incident involving a certain woman in Sidon who stayed with her husband 10 years, and she did not give birth. They've been married for 10 years, they didn't have a child. They came to Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai and sought to separate from one another. They wanted a get. He said to them, by your lives, just as you came together with food and drink, you had a wedding, so too you shall separate only with food and drink. You have to have an unwedding. You have to have a meal together. They followed his advice. They made a celebration for themselves. They made a great feast, and she got him to drink in excess. He drank extra. Just looking back in the original Hebrew to see whether it says that she got him to in the Hebrew, because I didn't remember that. Maybe you could read it as her initiative. Unclear. When he was in good spirits, he said to her, my daughter, see any good item that I have in the house? Take it and go to your father's house. Take whatever you want, he says to her. What did she do? After he fell asleep, she motioned to her servants and maidservants and said to them, carry him in his bed and take him to my father's house. At midnight, he awakened from his slumber after his wine had abated. He said to her, my daughter, where am I? She said to him, in my father's house. He said to her, what am I doing in your father's house? She said to him, is that not what you said to me in the evening? See any good item that I have in the house? Take it and go to your father's house. There is no item in this world better for me than you. They went to Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, and he stood and prayed for them, and they were remembered, meaning that she conceived, to teach you that just as the Holy One, blessed be He, remembers the barren, so too the righteous cause the barren to be remembered. And additional matters may be remembered via kal vachomer, a fortiori. If a flesh and blood woman, because she said to another of flesh and blood, there is no item in this world better for me than you, she was remembered. Israel, who are waiting for the salvation of the Holy One, blessed be He every day, and say there is nothing good in the world other than you, all the more so. So this Medrash is saying that just like they were able to get back together, so too the Jews can get back together with God. That's the type of Midrash that you see in Shir HaShirim Rabbah. It is full of hope. And then you see certain Midrashim which go even further and make statements which are strong and apparently somewhat strange. And I wanted to bring you two examples of this because they're going to lead us to the thesis that Dr. Kadari is proposing. So take a look at number 3. Medrash again, Shir HaShirim Rabbah, on the line, Ki Tovim Dodecha Miyayin. Your love for me is greater than wine. So the Medrash here takes it in a very different, very interesting direction. It says, Ki Tovim Dodecha Miyayin, Divrei Torah Domin Zeh LaZeh. Matters of Torah are similar to each other. They resemble each other. They are dodin zelazeh. They are companions to one another. Krovin zelazeh. They are close to each other. Just as you say, or his uncle, dodo, or his cousin. Dodecha means your love, but we're using it to say not just the love is greater, but the words of Torah are greater than wine. And then it continues to say, Shimon bar Abba said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, Chavivin divrei sofrim, Kedivrei Torah. The words of the Sofrim, they translated here as scribes. That's a mistake. It means the words of the rabbis. The term Sofer, those of you who learned Ezra with me will remember this. The word Sofer does not have to mean scribe. The word Sofer can mean a teacher. So what it's saying is rabbinic teachings are as beloved as the words of the Torah are. The Rabbanans are as beloved as the Oraisas. Matam, why? Because the text says, V'chikech kiyein hatov. Your palate, the words you speak, are like fine wine. And then we're told, their translation is incomplete. That's really interesting. Oh, no, it's not. I made a mistake. I jumped the line. That's why. Chavraya b'shem Rabbi Yochanan. The scholar said the name of Rabbi Yochanan, Chavivin divrei sofrim mi divrei Torah. The words of the rabbis are even more beloved than the words of the Torah. Ki tovim dodecha miyayin. Your dodim, your words, are even greater than wine. So that, if a person says there's no such thing as tefillin, contradicting the words of the Torah, he's exempt from liability. Whereas, if a person says that they should have 5 boxes in the tefillin instead of 4, so they're adding, then they're chayav, they're liable. I'm not going to go into the issue of adding and contradicting. That's not relevant for us. The point for us, and what I wanted to catch your attention with, is the statement that the words of the rabbis are more beloved than the words of the Torah itself. How could you explain that? What does that mean to you?
I don't know, but it sounds very self-serving.
Doesn't it sound self-serving? It does until you realize where it's coming from. Chana?
I think that the words of Torah have to be explained by Chazal. You can't take them literally.
Mm.
But Chazal is not literal.
It's a statement that we need rabbinic tradition. Could be. Definitely could be. Hold the Medrash and look at one more Medrash before we get to Dr. Kadari's point. Take a look at source number 4, please. This is on the line in Shir HaShirim, in Song of Songs, in which they're told to go out and look Ba'atarash Itralo Imo, to look at the crown that Solomon's mother gave him. Something like that. Benot Zion Bamelech Shlomo. Go look at, the daughters of Zion should go look at King Solomon. Ba'atarash Itralo Imo Biyom Chatunato. At the crown that his mother gave him on the day of his wedding. Got it? That's the line in Shir HaShirim. Go out and look at the crown that Solomon's mother gave him. So look at this weird medrash. Ba'atarashi tralo imo, the crown that his mother crowned him with. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yochanan said, Shal Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai et Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai asked Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Yossi, Amar lo, Efshe sheshamata me'avicha mahu ba'atarashi tralo imo, did your father, Rabbi Yossi, ever teach anything about this line in Song of Songs? I don't get the line. I need your help. Did your father, Rabbi Yossi, one of the greatest of the sages of the Mishnah, did he ever teach anything about this? Amar Lohein, he said yes. Amar Loheach, he said, what did he teach? Right, you ever have that? When you ask somebody like, do you know what time it is? And they say yes. This is like, do you know anything about this line? Yes. What did he say? Amar Lo, he said, L'melech shahayisalo bas yechida. This is to be compared to a king who had a single daughter, just one daughter, Vayamachabava Yoser Midai, and he went overboard. He loved her exceedingly much, as they translated here, I see. Vayakoriosa Biti, he always called her my daughter, Velozazme Chavava Shikara Osa Chosi, but he then grew in his love, and he called her my sister, and he continued until he called her Imi, my mother. A statement of demonstrating greater and greater love for her. That's how Hashem loved the Jews exceedingly. He called us BT, and he quotes a pasuk, a verse in Tehillim, and then he calls us Achosi, borrowing from Shir HaShirim, and then he calls us Imi, my mother, and that's the reference to us. So in other words, when it says that there was a crown that Solomon's mother gave him, it doesn't mean Solomon's mother. It means the Jewish people. That's what's going on. It's the crown that the Jews gave to Shlomo. And Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is so amazed. Last line of the Medrash. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai gets up, v'nashko al rosho, he kisses him on his head, v'amar, and he said, ilu lo basi al lishmo epicha tam hazeh daya. Had I only come to hear this one line from you, that would already be enough. And so the question is, why? Why is that better than any other medrash? What was the remarkable insight in this?
And why, if you wanted to say the Jewish people, why don't you write that?
Well, the question of why the Medrash says it, sorry?
I mean, why, you know, if they wanted to say Jewish people, they say the Jewish people. If they want to say mother, you write mother. You don't get that wrong.
Except that the Medrash is arguing that that is what it's saying. In other words, this is a way for the text to show the love for the Jews. I said last time, I don't think you were on when I said it. In looking at the Medrash on Shir HaShirim, I'm not doing all the analysis of where the Medrash gets it from, because then we'll be here for the entire rest of the year, like when we did Noach. So I need to not do that this time. So Dr. Kedari says she has an explanation for why. And actually, I was talking on Shabbos with Professor Mark Herman. I don't know how many of you have had a chance to meet him yet. He's relatively new in town. But he's in the Judaics department at York. Might be head, actually, the Judaics department at York. And I was talking to him about this, and he said that Dr. Kedari's thesis does seem to be sort of the standard thinking now about Shir HaShirim Rabbah and its approach to Shir HaShirim. Dr. Kedari picks up on some interesting aspects of the structure in Shir HaShirim Rabbah. First of all, she notes that it's unusual among Medrash collections in that it covers nearly every sentence in Shir HaShirim. It's only missing 5 sentences out of the 117 that are found in the book, as opposed to Bereishis Rabbah, which misses about 25% of the book of Bereishit. Vayikra Rabbah, which misses 18%, this only misses 4%. And not only that, but the 5 sentences it skips are repeated sentences that show up elsewhere in the Midrash. So it's not like it's skipping it, it just deals with it elsewhere. It does it in order. Shir HaShirim Rabbah goes sentence by sentence. So she suggests that the goal is to explain the entire book. And not only that, when a verse in Shir HaShirim does not have a direct Midrash, the compiler of Shir HaShirim Rabbah moves Midrashim from elsewhere in Shir HaShirim Rabbah in order to cover it. So for example, there's a verse, Mayafit Umana Amt, towards the end of Shir HaShirim in chapter 7. How beautiful you are. And we don't have a Medrash on those words in Shir HaShirim Rabbah, but he imports from an earlier verse, Hinach Yafa Rayati, Hinach Yafa, and he applies it to Mayafitu Mana Amt, because they're similar. Or he brings in Midrashim that appear in other collections of Medrash without a reference to Shir HaShirim, and he adds a verse from Shir HaShirim to it. And Kedari gives examples. Why do this? What are the benefits of this book, which covers the entire Sefer and imports Midrashim to do it? So one benefit of it is to demonstrate that Shir HaShirim really is part of the canon. Because look, we have all of these sages developing and presenting Midrashim about it, from beginning to end. This is clearly part of the canon. There are other benefits as well, which Kedari goes into, but I'm not going to spend time on. But the main insight is to read Shir HaShirim Rabbah as a polemical work defending the status of the Jews as Hashem's nation. Remember, we talked about when Shir HaShirim Rabbah is compiled. The Midrashim are ancient. It's compiled, though, we said, somewhere around 7th century. The Jews are living under the Christians. The Christians are promoting what can be called replacement theology or supersessionism. They ask Kyrie Irving, for those who follow that kind of news. The idea that the Christians are the new Jews. The church argued that you should read Shir HaShirim to show that the Jews failed to live up to God's vision for them, and that's why the Jews were replaced. Hashem came knocking at the door, and the Jews did not answer. As an example of it, I brought you source number 5 from Bishop Origen. Maybe I should just call him Origen. I don't know. Bishop Origen. He's commenting here, as you can see, on Shir HaShirim chapter 1. He says, here again, the person of the... Oh, this is on the line, I should explain. The line in Shir HaShirim in which the female voice says of herself, Shchara ani v'nava benos Yerushalayim. I am black and beautiful, or black but beautiful, daughters of Jerusalem. Like the tents of Kedar and the tents of Solomon. So Origen says, here again the person of the bride is introduced as speaking. But she speaks now not to those maidens who are wont to run with her, but to the daughters of Jerusalem. To these, since they have spoken slightingly about her as being ugly, she now makes answer. This bride who speaks represents the church, gathered from among the Gentiles. But the daughters of Jerusalem to whom she addresses herself are the souls who are described as being most dear because of the election of the fathers, but enemies because of the gospel. So in other words, what Origen is saying is the female voice is actually the church. The daughters of Jerusalem are the Jews who originally were selected because of their ancestry. I'm just going to be turning on the transcript for people. If you don't want the transcript, you could always just turn it off for yourself. We've discussed how. But it was requested. So the Jews are these daughters of Jerusalem who were selected originally and then rejected. Those are, therefore, the daughters of this earthly Jerusalem, who, seeing the church of the Gentiles, despise and vilify her for her ignoble birth. For she is baseborn in their eyes, because she cannot count as hers the noble blood of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So Origen says, the Jews look down on the church, saying that the church is lacking in heritage, and the bride knows that the daughters of the former people impute this to her, and that because of it they call her black, as one who has not been enlightened by the patriarch's teaching. And she answers their objections thus, I am indeed black, O daughters of Jerusalem, in that I cannot claim descent from famous men. Neither have I received the enlightenment of Moses' law, but I have my own beauty all the same, ... So in Origen's mind, and this was the way the church looked at it, and frankly, probably still the way the church looks at it, Song of Songs is a statement of the love that God now has for the church and the rejection of the Jews. The business about black not being beautiful is an aesthetic that was there at the time. It's really that straightforward. We have other ways we can read that line, but the simple read is that black was not considered attractive. It was considered to be darkened by the sun. So along comes the Medrash on Shir HaShirim, and it argues that Shir HaShirim highlights how we are special. Now we understand why it's so important, this debate between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda, about whether you could read anything negative about the Jews in Shir HaShirim. We insist, no, never read it for Gnai, never read it as a put-down of the Jews. There are Midrashim that read negative statements into Shir HaShirim, but those don't make it into Shir HaShirim Rabbah. It speaks of Hashem's love for us, even when we are in exile, even when we are remote, even after the 10 years of not being able to produce children, the love is still there from Hashem for us. And so it says, rabbinic teachings are even more beloved than the written Torah, because that was a major point of conflict between the Jews and the church. That's what this is. It's a polemic regarding how we look at rabbinic teaching. And Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and this business of the mother of King Solomon. Remember that we saw in previous weeks the line in the Talmud that says that all the references to King Solomon in Shir HaShirim are actually a reference to? Right, Chana says it, she's muted, but a reference to Hashem. Well, that means Hashem has a mother. That's a problem. So take a look at source number 6. Dr. Kedari says, Nir'ah ki yesh lecha peses hatam le'inyan b'pasuk mishir HaShirim gimel yedalef. He says, you could look for an explanation for this in that line from Song of Songs, chapter 3, sentence 11. Zoi apam hayachida ban nizkeret imo shel Shlomo b'chol megilat Shir HaShirim. That's the only place Solomon's mother is mentioned in Shir HaShirim. Parshanut ha-pasuk ba'open miluli, translating that literally, ke'osef b'shlomo ha-melech u'batsheva imo, saying it's King Solomon and his mother Batsheva, which Kedari thinks is Rabbi Yochanan's view. I don't necessarily agree with her on that, but I'm not spending time on that right now. Einam me'oreret kol ba'aya parshanit. If you read it as King Solomon, you're fine. You have no exegetic problem. Solomon has a mother. Her name is Batsheva. We know a lot about her. Hakoshi befanav nitzav Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai novea mikach shehu me'unyan ledreshet ha-pasuk ba'ofen allegory. But Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai doesn't believe that. He thinks that you read Shir HaShirim allegorically, and the references to the king are a reference to Hashem. Below ba'ofen miluli, not literally. Ketzad ital nefaresh ha-pasuk ba'ofen allegory kishlamohu HaKadosh Baruch Hu im la-melech zeh yesh na'im. How can you read it that Solomon refers to God if this king has a mother? And the answer is that he goes on to say also, suggesting that God is born of a woman and so on. The answer is, mother doesn't mean mother, mother means nation. That's the way that Shir HaShirim Rabbah is resolving it. So Shir HaShirim Rabbah is one long text without any clear internal divisions, interestingly, in the original, meant to be read straight through, and by a diverse audience. It has things that are meant for scholars. It has things that are meant for lay people. It has technical references in it that are suitable for the very educated. A lot of it, though, can be read by anyone on any level. And it's meant to convey the idea that the Jews are a special nation against what the church is promoting. You follow? It's fantastic. I love what Kedari does here. And I'm going to add a point. You'll remember that when we did the introduction to the book, we noted Rabbi Akiva specifically saying that the book is holy of holies. And we already noted that it fits for Rabbi Akiva because it speaks about our love for God, and Rabbi Akiva emphasized our love for God, the whole thing about when he was dying and v'ahavta v'chol nafshecha, right? We talked about that. But Rabbi Akiva is also the champion of Hashem's love for us. That's a very big point for Rabbi Akiva. I brought you source number 7, the classic Mishnah from the end of Masechet Yoma. Amar Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Akiva says, Ashreichem Yisrael, you are fortunate, Israel. Lifnei mi atem mitarin, mi mitar eschem, before whom are you purified? Who purifies you? Avichem Shabbat Shamayim, your Father in heaven, Hashem is the one who purifies you. Shenemar, and he quotes the Pasuk, I will sprinkle pure water on you and purify you. Hashem is the mikvah of the Jewish people. Just like the mikvah purifies human beings, so too God purifies Israel. So what you're seeing here is is an expression of Hashem's love for us, and Rabbi Akiva says that is Kodesh Kadashim, that is Holy of Holies. We're going to see another reason when we see Rashi for why Rabbi Akiva loves this book. But that, to me, is a second dimension. There is a lot we could spend time on in Shir HaShirim Rabbah. We could be talking about how it handles some of the more difficult verses, its methods of analyzing verses, but we have limited time for Shir HaShirim in our survey, so I think I'm going to take questions and comments on the Midrash layer and then move on to Rashi. Questions and comments. Okay, then we're going to go further. That's one layer in reading Shir HaShirim. I'm going to actually make the...